The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Tim McKenna is off this week. We start our show with local and national news with two very popular and influential people in our bicycle world. Last week, Chris Cagle, owner of the Wheel and Sprocket Bicycle Shops in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer and is currently being treated in hospital. The entire industry is really shocked and saddened by this turn of events, as Chris is and always has been one of the most loved and generous people in our special world. At the opening breakfast of Interbike, which just closed yesterday, there is a breakfast on Wednesday, and Pat Huss, who is the head of Interbike, gave a beautiful speech about Chris, and I guess 750 teary-eyed participants raised their glasses in Chris's honor. We can all follow Chris's website at Chris Cagle, that's K-E-G-E-L.com. His family is updating it as they have news. There is a special ride for him tomorrow, a slow roll. You'll see that on his site, too. So we wish Chris and his family all the best. Our second piece of news, which, while it has more of a local flavor because she's a Clevelander, has had some national coverage. On Sunday, September 18th, Shelley Snyder, who is a founding member of our BikeCleveland.org advocacy group, was hit by a motorist traveling at 60 miles an hour while she was traveling from Cleveland to the West Coast. She was in Montana at the time. She was going to meet up with her fiancé, and as the story unfolded, an angel in the form of a local Montana veterinarian who just happened to be passing by and who got out of her car, sat with Shelley for the what seemed evidently like an interminable amount of time until medical help could get to her. As of this show, which is being recorded on Thursday, Shelley was in surgery. They were trying to relieve some of the pressure on her brain. The amount of support she's been getting has just been phenomenal. There is a GoFundMe.com page for Shelley, and the reason that it's up there isn't because she doesn't have insurance, but she does. But it will be a huge amount of money to get her on a life flight from Montana back to the neurosurgeons here in Cleveland. To date, it's been about $40,000 that have been collected. There are all kinds of fundraisers for her. If you want to know more about what's going on with her, and she's just this, I guess everybody who meets her just literally falls in love with her. It's GoFundMe.com, and it's Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-I, Snyder. We look forward to talking about some good news now. My first guest, and we do have guests this week, is Barbara McCann. She is widely known as the founder of the Complete Streets Coalition. Ms. McCann was tapped by the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, to head up the Office of Safety, Energy, and Environment in 2013. Today we're going to talk with her about the work that she's doing and learn what the Department of Transportation has up its sleeve for the coming months. So you may remember that we kept saying, oh, we're going to talk to Barbara McCann. We're going to talk to Barbara. Well, we've postponed it until now because evidently she's going to have some new stuff to tell us. And I'm kind of interested to hear what she has to say. We're also going to speak with former racer, author, and now inventor Thomas Prenn. We've had great conversations with Thomas in the past. He was with Cat Eye and he's done some other things. And now he has a product which, when you hear about it and see it, is one of those smack yourself in the head and say, well, why didn't I think of that? His idea is a synchronized lighting system, which was just launched on Kickstarter. And we'll ask Thomas how he came up with the idea, how it works, and when it's going to be available. It's very, very clever. Thomas also did spend a couple of days at Interbike. He rode from Grand Junction to Las Vegas. He raced Cross Vegas, which is a World Cup cyclocross race, and stayed through Friday. So we're going to get his sort of feedback on what went on at Interbike besides the industry breakfast for Chris. Finally, we have a most unusual story with a bicycling twist. Eric Masterson is an ornithologist. Now, you can type that in real quick if you don't know what that is, but he's a bird guy. He hails from Ireland, but currently lives in New Hampshire. And that's not exactly true because currently he's on a 5,000-mile journey by bicycle tracing the migratory route of the broad-winged hawk, which is a raptor. The story's fascinating. I can't wait to hear all about it. So first, let's welcome Barbara McCann to The Outspoken Cyclist. Barbara, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. I'm really glad to be with you.
It's nice. How's Washington today? I take it you are there.
Yes. Yes, we are in D.C. I'm at the DOT headquarters building.
Very nice. So I know your name and I know who you are because of the work you did before coming to the Department of Transportation in Complete Streets. Tell us a little bit about your background in bicycle and pedestrian advocacy before joining Anthony Fox and the team there.
Well, I first became involved in pedestrian and bicycle advocacy when I was trying to ride my bicycle to work. When I was a journalist, I was working at CNN in the early 90s in Atlanta. And it's not the greatest place to ride, was not at that time the greatest place to ride a bicycle. And also the region was going through a lot of discussion about how the region was growing and what the transportation infrastructure was like. So I started to actually do some reporting on transportation issues for CNN and also became engaged in the local conversation. And from that, I got sucked into the transportation issues. I came here to Washington to work for a general transportation advocacy group in the late 90s. And from there, I worked with a wide variety of organizations. And at some point, there was a strong interest in what more could be done to routinely integrate or routinely accommodate bicycles and pedestrians into the transportation planning process, which at that time was very oriented to automobiles. And I was involved in a process by which we came up with the term complete streets to describe this policy orientation of making sure that the roads are safe for all users. And once we came up with it, it became clear to me that it was a real initiative that needed more work. So I spent quite a bit of time researching places that were doing something along these lines, developing a national coalition that became the National Complete Streets Coalition, and then working for policy adoption around the country. And so I led the National Complete Streets Coalition through 2012, took a little time off at that point to write a book about my experiences there. And the coalition has continued. It's really been gratifying to see it continue as I have shifted to a different space in my work.
When I think about complete streets, I think it's almost become sort of universal in the U.S. that almost everybody's adopting a complete streets program. It's obviously pretty successful. Does it look the way you thought it would? Has it changed a lot since you first kind of, you know, designed it and implemented it?
Well, it's been very gratifying to see it spread as much as it has and to see how many places have really embraced the importance of making sure that the streets are safe for everyone. And in the mayor's challenge that we just did here at the department, we had 7 challenge areas, and the first of those areas was adopting a complete streets approach. And we saw progress. The neat thing is we're beyond the point with complete streets of it just being the few innovators. We do see it happening in many states, many metropolitan planning organizations, and of course, many, many cities are adopting this approach. And once you make that decision that you're going to design your roads for the, in this more inclusive and safe way for everyone, it leads to a lot of other changes, a lot of changed decision-making processes and changed designs. And we see that happening across the country. And there certainly is a lot happening that that I was never have anticipated, and it certainly happened more quickly, I think, than I originally had thought it might.
Wow, most people think things take too long. That's pretty cool that it's happening more quickly than you would think. So I want to talk a little bit about safety, and I know that part of this mayor's challenge, in fact, the third item of the awards was gather and track biking and walking data. And data is sometimes hard to find when it concerns cyclists and pedestrians, especially in terms of safety and crashes and those kinds of things. But I see that you really are addressing this. Can you tell us a little bit about the Summit for Safer People and Safer Streets and what that was all about?
Yes, absolutely. So last Friday, we had the summit to celebrate what we've been doing in the last 2 years around really talking more and having more attention on pedestrian and bicycle safety. And a big part of that has been around data, because we don't have a lot of information. We know that pedestrian and bicyclist fatalities are going up, as they are also for automobile drivers. But we don't know that much about whether or not there are more people bicycling and walking, which obviously would have an impact on how many on the fatalities. So we have a lack of data about exposure, how much people are using it. We have a lack of data about the safe infrastructure. We have a lack of data about what's causing crashes. And this is not something that's only limited to pedestrian and bicycle issues. It's also an issue in a lot of other safety arenas. So we have launched a number of initiatives to try to understand better what's happening with safety. And at the summit, which was last Friday, we gathered together city leaders from around the country. We gave awards, round data, to the cities of Los Angeles, California, and Bellevue, Washington, because they're doing innovative things in identifying safety problems using data and addressing those. But at the summit, we had a session where we spent time talking about what the latest data is showing and hearing from the attendees about what more we could do to collect better data that will really help us focus. One of the things that I think is most telling is something that comes out of the research that Los Angeles has done, where they found that about 6% of their road network is where about 65% of their crashes are taking place for pedestrian and bike.
Wow.
And so that very immediately gives you clarity about where to prioritize changes. And that's the value of having really good data, is it can tell you what direction to go in terms of improving safety.
Well, I know that people can read the summit information and the strategic agenda that we also released recently online. And so I think we're going to make these links available. They come right out of Fastlane, don't they? Secretary Fox's blog. Yeah, Mayor's Challenge Winners Show.
Yeah,
Power
we actually
of
have we have some great resources that we'd love to have more people see. So the Secretary's blog, Fastlane, had a couple of entries last week that were about the summit and that have links. You can also just Google USDOT Mayor's Challenge, and the homepage now has links to, we did fact sheets about all of the challenge winners and about all the challenge areas. And we mentioned many, many cities, so people should go and look up and see if their city is mentioned, because we talked not just about the winners, but about all the cities engaged in the challenge who've been working in all these different areas. We also have, I think now there's kind of a neat interactive map where you can see the winning cities and read about them using that map, as well as a really neat roll of photographs from all these places all over the country and all the activity that they've taken on in the last couple of years. And I think a big lesson from the challenge has just been the thirst for just a little bit of structure and a little bit of support to really take action. And several people at the summit on Friday said that this was their inspiration to go from talking to doing. and to really implement some of the things they've been talking about. And that was really gratifying to hear that and inspirational to us here at the department.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Barbara McCann. She is at the U.S. Department of Transportation. And the next thing I want to talk about is the Federal Highway Administration's strategic agenda for pedestrian and bicycle transportation. So it has an enormous amount of information, including the mayor's challenge stuff. And it does have some data about crashes and trends and priorities. Who was this agenda written for? Who will be using this? It's a huge document, really.
Yes, we're really excited that that Federal Highways has been working on the strategic agenda for quite some time, and it's the culmination of a really big research project they've had going on for several years. And it's really many people who've been in pedestrian and bicycle advocacy for a while are aware that some years ago Federal Highways put out a study on pedestrian, there's really two studies on walking and on biking, and that really looked, were very forward-looking for their time, and this is really the next step of that, and it's partially directed internally at what we in the department do, and then what we do with our federal partners and with our state and local partners, but it's certainly something that we hope will help frame the way we talk about pedestrian and bicycle use across the country. It one of the nice things that it does is it sets out some very clear goals for what we want to achieve in increasing the number of people who are using bicycling and walking as modes of transportation, and in reducing fatalities and injuries, and in fact reducing fatalities eventually to zero. So that's a very inspirational message, and I think will really help guide our work over the years. And I do encourage people to take a look at it, and there's opportunity for feedback on it, and we'd love to partner with as many organizations as possible on moving it forward. I think here I'm in the Secretary's office, of the overall Department of Transportation, but we are really we worked with Federal Highways on the strategic agenda and expect to continue to work with them, and a number of the other modes of the department are also engaged in it. So I think it's going to be a guidepost for us for some time.
Since you have such a lot of background and information and sort of knowledge about bicycles and pedestrians interacting and or not interacting with cars, if it was a perfect world, what do you think could happen to make drivers more aware of cyclists and pedestrians, to keep cyclists safer? I mean, are we going to separate riders from traffic? And how are we going to address the – I think there's a lot of anger and contentiousness and rage out there right now.
Well, I think that there's kind of two different issues I'd like to address here. One is there are a lot of things we know that work to improve safety. For example, we know that road diets work, that reduce the automobile traffic lanes and provide more space for pedestrians and bicyclists. They can reduce crashes by as much as 40 or 50%. And Federal Highways has done a lot of work to push those out. And there's other examples of other infrastructure pieces that work. There's also examples of countermeasures that work on the behavioral side, such as these coordinated education and enforcement campaigns that enforce yielding behaviors among drivers. And they have a proven track record of improving compliance and better behavior. So these are not universally used out in the world. And so the first thing to do is to get those things, those countermeasures, those strategies into place. And then the second thing I think is that there's a lot of things we don't quite know yet. If we're trying to ultimately eliminate fatalities, there's a lot of work to be done in understanding, partially through data, like the data that Los Angeles has found, and I think New York has found similar, where you zero in on certain places that have more crashes. And there's other strategies that we're going to need to develop. So I don't think that there's like one silver bullet. It's both using more of what we already know works, and then developing new areas and new strategies.
You know, I always bring up the fact that our infrastructure is failing in so many places, and there's been so much focus on the automobile and on oil and on bridges and on roads. And we do know that narrowing streets doesn't only help with traffic, it also helps with business. You know, that's sometimes left out of that mix, that people will stop more at a business when, you know, there's a place to park near it and they're not going 55 miles an hour down the road. They're only going 25. Oh, there's some place I want to go over there. Do you believe that government will stay on track when it comes to infrastructure and safety? I mean, you guys are doing a great job, but, you know, you have Congress to work with and a new administration coming up. Do you see things that are going to keep allowing you to move forward with this?
Yes, well, I think safety is really the department's number one priority, and I don't anticipate that changing anytime. When you were talking from a moment ago about how these changes have other benefits, one of the documents that Federal Highways put out recently was some performance measures, various performance measures that cities and some states have been using to gauge the success of their pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure, and it includes measures that have to do with business use and that sort of thing. And so I think that part of our role in this area is really to help spread those best practices from around the country. And it's pretty clear that we want our transportation system to do more than get people from A to B. We want it to help build more vital communities. We want it to provide ladders of opportunity for people to get to school and jobs. And we need to be measuring those kinds of changes. And I think there's a lot of local activity around that we want to support, as well as we have some projects, some federal projects around that. And I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation, and I don't really see that changing.
I appreciate that the Department of Transportation is doing what it's doing, because, you know, my listeners both ride and walk more than anything else. That is their, especially riders, you know, we're cyclists, and some of us are road cyclists, some of us are afraid to be on the road today. You know, because it's scary. And it's nice to know that there's a lot of things happening within the Department of Transportation that is beginning to address all those issues. I would like to make sure that it's okay to post the links to the Transportation's Fast Lane page for the Mayor's Challenge and for the forward-looking agenda. I take it that's okay?
Oh, absolutely. And so we have the Mayor's Challenge page, can help lead people all over. Federal Highways has a great page also on pedestrian and bicycle, their pedestrian bicycle program that has bukus of links as well. So,
well, I really appreciate you talking with me today, and I'm really excited to see all these cool things happening, because it's been a tough summer. we're looking for some solutions, and I know data helps, but knowing that you have our backs a little bit is helpful too. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate all the work that's happening around the country. Has been a huge inspiration to us.
That's great. Well, if you see him, say hello to Secretary Fox and have a great fall. And I hope you get out on your bike soon.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Barbara. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Barbara McCann from the Department of Transportation talked to me from Washington, D.C. They are some really nice initiatives. It's transportation.gov/FastLane/Mayor's Challenge or DOT unveils forward-looking agenda. So we need to take a real quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
On Saturday, October 9th, from noon till 4 p.m., you can enjoy the sights, smells, and tastes of autumn in Northeast Ohio at Lake Metro Park's Penitentiary Glen Reservation. Journey through fall colors, get creative with a craft, learn how wildlife prepare for the coming season, or hike one of the many park trails. Free to all ages welcome. Penitentiary Glen Reservation is at 8668 Kirtland Chardon Road in Kirtland. More info at lakemetroparks.com. Click on events.
Good afternoon, Thomas. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. How are you?
I am well, and thank you very much. It's delightful to be back on your show.
Well, how is Las Vegas one of my not most favorite places on the planet?
Yes. Well, it is, I don't know, I think it's the same. How about that?
The same is a good answer, because some things don't change.
Yeah.
That is one thing about it. You can depend on it being the same.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to talk about your new Kickstarter campaign for your synchronized lighting system, but I would like you to just give us a little bit. Nobody, I haven't talked with anybody from Interbike. I've seen a lot of pictures, but nobody's really telling me anything. How was Cross Vegas, which is now a World Cup race?
Oh, I have to tell you, it was so spectacular. I think the energy at Cross Vegas is probably one of the best single races that we've had in the United States in a long time. It's so great. I mean, for a lot of reasons, because it's cyclocross, because a ton of the bike industry is there and comes out for it. I mean, in fact, it's interesting that Cross Vegas is its own draw now. I mean, you know, before it was that, you know, Cross Vegas was sort of tagging along with Interbike, and it's not to say that Interbike isn't important or anything, but it's just that now people, there are a lot of people who are coming out, and they're coming out for Cross Vegas, and they're also then going to the show. So I actually traveled with a buddy from Grand Junction, Colorado. We rode here. I don't know if you knew that.
I did. Yeah. You did tell me that. I'm like, well, that's cool, but you're not riding home.
No. one way is good enough.
Yeah, I guess.
It was a long, nice long ride, about 120 a day, with one at 137, I think.
How many days was it?
It was 5 days.
Oh, it was a long trip.
It was a long trip. And, you know, but I have to say that some of the most spectacular gravel riding that I have ever done, and it was a route that I did one time before, and looking at Strava heat maps, I know that I'm the only person at least who has ever done a Strava, laid down Strava tracks across this big high desert plateau is actually spectacular.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I am special on Strava. What could be better than that? Tell me a little bit about Interbike. Did you see anything that just blew you away besides your own product?
Well, my product was the coolest product. It was not seen at Interbike because I'm just been showing it to sort of friends and family. So it really sort of has not been seen at Interbike. You know, a couple of interesting things that are trends that have been developing over a while that I think are really solidifying. I don't know that we has anyone coined a name for this bike that's sort of the one bike that rides on cyclocross and gravel, and then you can swap out, you know, your disc wheels and ride the road.
When you say swap out your discs, are you saying that there are accoutrements to put caliper brakes on it?
It's a disc brake bike that can take the clearance of a cross tire or gravel grinder tire, but you throw in your road wheels, and you have a beautiful road bike if you're riding faster on the road.
What do you think dealers are thinking about? I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of talk about Chris Cagle, who is very sick. And I know that everybody just, you know, raised a glass to him. But besides Chris and Cross Vegas, what else were dealers kind of talking about this year? Are you seeing any trends?
A lot of dealers are talking about the industry in general, which has been a rough year for a lot of people. So I think as a result, dealers are a little cautious. There's certainly a lot of discussion, a lot of product talk about rider safety. You know, it's a big issue, and that's actually one of the reasons why I think, you know, what I've developed is actually very, very cool. Because it looks at safety in a completely fresh way to make us clearly more safe rather than just brighter. But that's, I mean, so there are a lot of, I mean, I think almost every helmet company has a helmet with a light now on it. And so people are doing all sorts of things of trying to sort of add light to to bikes or somehow make them safer. So that's a trend out there that's certainly going on, which is, I think, bodes well for what I'm trying to do as well, too. So.
Well, and that's what I want to do. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Thomas Prenn. We are going to talk about his new product, which is in kind of its final stages of development. I don't know if you're tweaking it at all, but tell us a little bit about the synchronized lighting system. I don't know why nobody thought of it before. It's like you look at it and go, duh, why didn't I think of that? But you yeah, thought of it, so you get it.
I did think of it. So, yes, I did think of it. So the evolution of it was this. I was, I'm a photographer and shoot some video, and I was following some riders. And in the process of this, there was a rider that had three lights. He had one in his helmet, he had one in his messenger bag, and he had one, or maybe it was a backpack, and he had one on the bike. And they were all flashing at different rates. As I'm filming him and afterwards reviewing him, I'm looking at him and realizing this guy isn't any more visible than someone with one light. And why is that? And it led me down this path of discovery of a science called human motion perception. And in human motion perception, we have the ability through hundreds of thousands of years of evolution to find patterns in nature. And when we see that pattern, we understand it as something that we can follow. It's what our ability was to sort of stay safe in the jungle, I guess. And so when you have synchronized lights that flash together in unison, you create a pattern that is much more visible to humans than just one light that has no reference points. And the easiest way for me to equate this is imagining a pilot seeing a radio tower, three lights flashing in unison, and those lights are spread out. They're spread out for a reason, because they create the object for us to see, or for the pilot to see, and as those lights get further and further apart from each other, we instinctively know that object is approaching us, or we're approaching that object. And that's the exact same science that I've put into the lights. Three lights on the back behind you are much better than one, and three lights in unison is what you want to create. So I have worked very hard on the technology to have it's basically Bluetooth, except that I'm not licensing Bluetooth because I'm only linking four lights together, a maximum of four lights together. There's no reason to have Bluetooth because we're not linking it to any smartphones right now.
But it is wireless.
It is completely wireless, yes. So they simply talk to each other. When you change the mode on one light, the other lights will change, which is cool. I mean, you turn one off and they all turn off. Hey, that's pretty cool. But the real beauty is that when you get to the flashing mode, and it's the mode that actually has 16 hours of runtime, they go and they talk to each other, so they get in unison. And you can actually see that when you're actually changing the light. You can actually see that they start off out of unison, and it takes maybe a second, and then all of a sudden they're all flashing in unison because they've talked to each other and say, here's the flashing pattern that we're, or here's the flashing rate, and here's the pulsing that we're gonna all do together. So very innovative and very unique, and I've applied for a patent on it. So I'm excited.
I have to say, it's pretty exciting. So I want people to be able to see it. And so do you have a website for it already besides the Kickstarter site?
Well, the best way for someone to see it would be to go to my website first, which is arsenalcycling.com. That's the easiest way to find it. And then click on the Kickstarter link. Now, I'm actually on the show floor right today, and tomorrow I will actually have product. Maybe by the time this show airs, I will actually have product on my site showing much more detail than the Kickstarter. So if they go to arsenalcycling.com, they will see it, and there will be a link direct to my Kickstarter, which goes until October 14th. I think that's a Friday.
Will you have product for holiday, or is that too soon?
That's my goal. My goal is if I'm trying to make it by holiday season. It's a bit challenging to do. I still have to get the production molds made and then the FCC license, because it requires an FCC license because it is wireless technology.
Isn't that interesting? Even though you're not really broadcasting anything, you need an FCC license. That's so interesting.
Well, it is actually broadcasting. It's broadcasting a wireless signal. Yeah, it's not a difficult thing. I mean, it's 2.4 gigahertz. Which is the same thing as Bluetooth, and so it's pretty cool. And a lot of thought has gone into the design of this, obviously, since I've been working in bike lighting technology forever, and LEDs, that in terms of making it as simple to use, and that's a really important thing, because cyclists don't want to, particularly cyclists who are cycling enthusiasts, they don't want to hassle with mounting systems, and they just want to put the light on the bike and turn it on and go ride, and that's it. And that's the way I've designed it, to be very, very simple to use and operate. And so it really is something that, on an everyday commute, you're not going to have a hassle, getting it on the bike, riding, and then if you want to recharge it that evening or at work, you can do that.
You have a front white light and three rear red lights. They all look individual, so you can put them in different places, right? You don't have to put like one on a seat stay and one on a handlebar and one on a helmet.
That's correct. You don't. Ideally, to create the maximum amount of visibility, you want to actually spread them out, because that actually, by actually spreading them out. But you bring up a good point. I on my Kickstarter, I'm either doing it as a set of three, because if people just want taillights, because they're just safety lights. They're the white front one, which is 40 lumens, is not really designed to project light out. It's project to just to strobe and be noticed, be seen by a motorist. You could get four taillights, four red lights, and actually put two, one on the bottom of each seat stay, one on the seat post, and let's say one on a helmet or a messenger bag or a backpack, something like that. And that, then you could have four taillights, and they would all be flashing in unison, and that would, that would create a high amount of visibility. And it's the spread apart and the unison of the flashing that creates the pattern that we have the ability to understand as an object.
Got it. So no matter what, you should have at least three red lights somehow flashing in unison. Do they have to be lined up, or can they?
They don't really have to be lined up, because it was interesting. I was talking to someone who does a lot of nighttime riding, and he actually has almost a stick that goes out like 3 feet, and so he wants to put in helmet, seat post, one out on the stick, and then one low on the bike. So he creates a sort of a box of light, but. It's going to do the same thing. As long as they're spread out, you're actually creating something that is more visible.
Well, I got to tell you, I think it's clever. I think it's important, and I think it's timely.
I have five more products.
You do?
That I want to bring to market. Oh, I do. And you know something? Some of them will not have any way for me to protect them, like a patent. But you know something? I don't care. I hope I can change the industry and the way we're thinking about rider safety, because we can make riders safer out there. I know that we can do that, and I'm dedicating my company to that. So that's my goal, and that's my company's objective.
This is way exciting, Thomas, and I'm really glad you're doing it. We will put the Kickstarter information on Facebook. We'll let it go on Twitter. This show will air this weekend, and I'll be in touch. And really, good luck with the product. Thank you for telling us about it. Do you have an actual name for it? I mean, synchronized bicycle safety lights is a little long.
It's a little long. It's called 4SYNC, the number 4, S-Y-N-C. So 4SYNC. Yeah, and it's because you can sync four of them together, so I'm calling it the 4SYNC. So that's a product name. If you did a search on Kickstarter, I think if you did bicycle lights, you might also find me. But it's kind of one of those challenging things because it's Kickstarter's been up for about a week now. It's sort of a little bit buried in there among other products. So,
well, thank you so much. Have a safe trip home, and we will talk again. We'll check in after the Kickstarter's over and see how things are going.
Absolutely great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thomas Pren joined me from Interbike. He is waiting to head back home after riding from Grand Junction. Wow, I didn't know it was going to take 5 days. We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Whether you remember poodle skirts, mini skirts, or bell bottoms,
you're just the right age.
Whether you liked Ike or loved Lucy,
your help is needed.
Even if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, or beyond, you can sign up to become an organ and tissue donor.
Think you're too old? Think again.
Any age is the right age to donate the gift of life.
Sign up today at organdonor.gov or call 1-866-99-DONATE.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Diane Jenks, we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to do a little bit of news. This comes from The Guardian by a woman named Laura Laker, and it starts out, when Mark Hodgson gets on his bike in the morning, like many cyclists in the UK, he has come to expect a few close calls. Yeah, haven't we all? Perhaps drivers will whiz past him too close, or someone will even try a punishment pass. Boy, there's a term I don't like. Luckily, Hodgson is a West Midlands police traffic officer, albeit in plain clothes, and just yards up the road, a colleague in a police car is waiting to pull over drivers that give him less than 1.5 meters space when overtaking, a distance that increases for faster speeds in larger vehicles, which is interesting because in the UK, evidently, the 3-foot law changes as speeds go up, which I didn't really realize, or as vehicles get bigger. That driver will be offered a choice: prosecution or 15 minutes education on how to overtake a cyclist safely. The worst drivers or repeat offenders will simply be prosecuted. What a concept, huh? This tactic is part of a groundbreaking new initiative launched by the West Midlands Police in partnership with Birmingham City Council to tackle cycling safety. So this morning, Hodgson and his colleagues pulled over 8 offenders within an hour, people who could have been prosecuted for their driving. Among those stopped were lorry drivers and a pupil under supervision by a driving instructor. It's like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to drive, and by the way, you better learn about cyclists, right? In many cases, drivers just aren't looking out for cyclists. He said, the last 2 drivers we pulled over, we asked, do you know how far away you were from the cyclist? And they said, what cyclist? One of those was the driver of a 7.5-ton vehicle. So the article goes on. It's quite a bit longer. If you'd like to read it, it's from theguardian.com, environment bike blog from September 16th. My second story was found kind of, and it's not really a story, it's just a website that I think might be of interest to a lot of our listeners. The website is called 55, and that's the number 55places.com. It lists the best communities for fitness fanatics, many of which include cycling. Some of them would not have been on my radar at all. So if you're interested, go to 55places.com, and there's a blog, and here are the best 55 plus communities for fitness fanatics. Now, I wouldn't say we're fanatics, but it's nice to know that they are doing something about cycling. My next story is not a happy story. It comes from the New York Times from September 18th, written by a guy named Ben Spiegel. From Rio de Janeiro, from the Paralympics, an Iranian cyclist died Saturday after an accident in a men's road race at the Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro. Baman Golbarmazad crashed on the mountainous section of the course known as the Grumari Loop. He was treated on the course and was being taken to the athlete's hospital, where he went into cardiac arrest, the IPC said. The ambulance rerouted to a closer hospital, where Golbarmazad died soon after arriving. He was 48. The Paralympic family is united in grief at this horrendous tragedy, which casts a shadow over what have been great Paralympic Games here in Rio, the IPC president, Philip Craven, said in a statement.
The Iranian flag was lowered to half-staff in the Paralympic Village and at Rio Centro, where Iran will play Bosnia and Herzegovina for the gold medal in sitting volleyball on Sunday. A moment of silence is scheduled for Sunday's closing ceremony. It's interesting. I find it interesting because he's 48. He was still competing. So on that note, I think that's a pretty good thing. That's really all the time we have news for today. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back with more of the show after a break.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Hi, Eric. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome, Dan. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, I want to know a little bit about your background and what you do. This is not the usual interview that we do, and you're using a bicycle for a very different reason. So tell us a little bit about you.
So I am 49. I'm Irish. I left Ireland at the age of 32 in 1999 after finishing a zoology degree in University College Dublin. And I moved to the States with my wife, Tricia, who's from Florida. And I moved over here partly because my wife is American and partly because there's a bigger market for a career in ornithology over here. So that's kind of a very short and sweet.
You're on an epic journey. It's very long. It's 5,000 miles. You're following the migration route of the broad-winged hawk. Tell us about this particular bird. What is it about it that sort of brought you on this journey?
So the broad-winged hawk is a very common bird. It's not under any serious threat. It's not a huge conservation concern, but it's an iconic species. And so, very briefly, it breeds across the eastern U.S., essentially east of the Mississippi River Valley. And a very large percentage of the population, they breed in North America, and they winter from Chiapas, Mexico, south into the Amazon Basin. And they found this really neat way of getting from North America to South America using very little energy. They essentially use updraft thermals to soar to South America, and that uses 1/30, 1/30 less energy than flapping flights. So it's, to draw an analogy with biking, it's like biking downhill all the way. And so it's a brilliant strategy that they use. But to do that, they have over millennia have developed this strategy whereby they pile on to essentially a highway, and the highway is the Appalachian Mountain Chain, which is where you get these updrafts and the thermal activity. And so hawks, if you can imagine an interstate, it's a good analogy with cedar roads. All of these hawks from surrounding areas piling onto the Appalachian Mountain Chain and heading south. And like a snowball, as they go south along the Appalachian Chain, the birds from Canada pass through territories south of, Canada, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and so forth, and more birds are piling onto this highway. And so where a big day of hawk watching in New Hampshire might be 1,000, 2,000 birds, by the time the snowball gets down to Corpus Christi, Texas, and other highways have joined in, you can have a big day of hawk watching with tens of thousands. And into Central America, in Mexico, there's a site, in Costa Rica, there's a site where you can have single-day counts of hundreds of thousands of hawks. There's a place in Costa Rica called Kekoli, and they have a record count from one day of 660,000 hawks. Not all broadwings, but many of those broadwings, and then some western species. And also helping causal factor in those massive numbers is the fact that the United States, the North American continent, is somewhat shaped like a funnel. So as these birds get funneled down into Central America, the concentration, they get very compacted.
Wow. There are a lot of questions that come up for me, about food and how they all get fed in the, as they get more dense and more dense. But it's just fascinating. So how did you come to decide to trace the migration, and what is it you're hoping to get out of it? We'll talk about the bike in a little bit. I'm more interested in the birds, frankly, right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's well, that's why I'm doing it, because it's so awesome. And I use the word awesome deliberately. My pet peeve is when I hear people using the word awesome about things that are really not awesome, but hawk migration. It's one of the most awesome natural history spectacles. It's one of the great natural wonders of the world, in my opinion. Well, but bird migration in general. And the thing about bird migration is, if so much of it is invisible, I do a lot of nocturnal bird migrant recording from my house in New Hampshire. That's where I live. And to do that, I have to go out during the dark hours, after dusk, and I put out a parabolic dish and a microphone and a recorder. And all of these guys are going out at night. And so you can't see migration by and large. And so hawk migration is, because they migrate during the day, it's a visible spectrum of a much larger phenomenon. And migration now, we're finding out, because of technology advances in, for instance, satellite transmitters are the battery technology and the way satellite transmitters are powered, the technology has advanced sufficiently whereby they can be put on smaller and smaller birds. Birds can essentially carry about 3% of their weight in excess baggage. So if you wanted to put a tracking device on a bird, you have to find one that weighs 3% or less of the bird's weight. And previously, technology didn't allow that for birds the size of broad-winged hawks. Well, technology is advancing now, so they're able to put transmitters on smaller and smaller birds. And what we're learning about these birds is nothing short of stupendous. It's incredible what they do. So I'm just blown away constantly by bird migration, and I thought to myself that it would make a great story because, as I described earlier, hawk migration it happens during the day, so it's something you can see, and these are iconic broad-winged hawk is an iconic species that not everybody knows about, but enough people know about, so it's a good hook for a story. Secondly, because they migrate south along a very defined pathway, which is the Appalachians, and then once they reach the southern end of the Appalachians, they migrate west to the Gulf Coast, and they essentially hug the Gulf Coast. And so the point I'm making is they follow a very narrowly defined pathway relative to other migrant birds. And my contention is where there's a path, there's a story. So that's the second reason where I can follow it because of the path. And then thirdly, I'm working with Hawk Mountain, hawkmountain.org. They're a wonderful raptor research organization based in Pennsylvania, slightly west of Allentown, on the Kittatinny Ridge, and they have put transmitters on several broad-winged hawks. And so I'm actually following south. I can't keep up with the hawks. They're too fast for me. But I will be visiting some of their roost sites where they roost, and hopefully when I get down to where they, you know, they'll get down to Brazil or wherever. I don't know where they're going to spend the winter, possibly Brazil, possibly Colombia, possibly Mexico, possibly Costa Rica. My dream is to be able to actually find one of them in the field to document and kind of close out the story.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Eric Masterson. He's an ornithologist following the migration of the broad-winged hawk, and he's doing it by bicycle, which we do want to know about that. So one of the things your website says is that you're using a combination of retro and cutting-edge technologies. What are you using? You say retro technology, like what?
Well, what I'm doing, I mean, retro is a bicycle, which is, you know, it's a 200-year-old piece of technology. My bike is a pretty good bike, but it's essentially, you know, relative to the technology that I'm using to track the birds, which is GPS and satellite technology, the bikes really haven't changed over 200 years. So the satellite transmitters, Hawk Mountain, to actually put a transmitter on a bird is a pretty laborious process. You've got to catch the bird. You've got to have a license to be able to do it. It's pretty controlled for the welfare of the birds. You've got to be trained to do it. You've got to have the funding to do it. And then you contract with these companies that make these units and have the satellite time. And so you basically get satellite feed for a year at a certain, you know, it's a fee-based process. And so they're providing me with data points of where the birds are as I need them. And they're essentially GPS points, you know, 42.... by 72.... or whatever it is. And I, if I'm near there, I'll go and I'll see if I can at least... I mean, what I'm trying to do is tell a story. In an ideal world, I wouldn't be using a bike. I'd be flying by flapping my arms, but I can't do that. So the reason I'm on a bike essentially is because I am truly astounded by these creatures, that by what they do. They're essentially, I mean, they're completely unaided. They don't have any technology. They are as they were born, with no extra bells and whistles. And so I thought, to be able to do justice to the story, I had to come as close to that as possible. So I could have done it in the car. I could have done it on a motorbike. To doing it by ultralight or something like that was way more technologically advanced and complex than I could handle. So I thought a bike was a really good, happy medium.
What kind of bike are you riding?
A Surly long-haul trucker.
Yeah, nice machine. Are you self-supported? I mean, do you have panniers and a sleeping bag and a tent and all of that stuff with you?
I do. I have a front two bag and a handlebar bag. And I must say, the first Ortleads I've had are... I did cycle touring. I'm not new to cycle touring. I've done some before. I did a pretty long trip in Northern Europe. And I actually bought a bike to do a London to Johannesburg trip. And I still have the bike, but the trip never happened because, for various reasons, I ended up doing it by by truck. I drove down, and so this is the trip. So I'm doing this trip for its own reasons, but it's also kind of a trip that I didn't do in Africa that I'm kind of doing now.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, are you encountering anything by bicycle that you didn't expect on this trip so far? I mean, you've come, what, 300 miles, 400 miles so far?
Yeah, I'm 500 miles in, so I'm about a tenth of the way in. A couple of things. Firstly, I never lost faith in humanity, but we're in election season now, as you know, and it's pretty depressing reading the news and being on Facebook, and I won't say I lost faith in humanity, but I was getting to a place where I was pretty jaded. And I have made a strict commitment to myself to be apolitical during this journey. So my blog, which is ericmasterton.com, I'm not going near politics in the blog because for a whole variety of reasons. And so it enabled me to think outside that box, because I was inside that box before I left on the trip. I found myself wrongly judging, you know, people by their, because I'm not going to get political now, but you know, I identified with people that thought like myself, and it's not a good place to be in. So I said to myself, you know, this is a new, I'm going to clean slate. I'm not going to do any of those silos or boxes. And I have to say, the people I have met on this trip have been, I mean, I've just met some fantastic, I haven't met anyone that I wouldn't describe as really friendly, and some people to a fault, just wonderful, wonderful people. It's been terrific. People saw a guy stopped on the side of the road, worked for, it was a really hot day. It was maybe 2 weeks ago. There were two 90-degree days, and I was stopped, and this guy pulled in, and he was an Eversource worker, which is our utility up in the New England area. And he said, you need some water, and he pulled out a big crate of water and filled up my bottles and that sort of thing, you know, just happening all the time. Really, really decent people. I'm actually in Gettysburg in a motel. And I've been on the road for 2 weeks, and this is the second paid night of maybe 2.5 weeks. So you're into almost 20 nights accommodation, and this will be the second night of a paid for night accommodation.
I hear this a lot from people traveling all over the country, just how generous and helpful and nice people are. It's just wonderful.
It is.
You intend to stick with this all the way down to South America. How long do you think it's going to take you? And you don't really have a destination. You're going to wait and see.
So I have 6 months, which I believe is enough time. And the poet in me is, I bike from my front door of my house. And the route that these hawks take, they're pretty faithful to this route. The Appalachian down to Georgia, then across to the Gulf Coast where they hit You know, they hit the Gulf Coast, say Corpus Christi, and then really they hug the Gulf Coast down into Mexico. Veracruz is a huge watch site in Mexico. And hawk watching is I know your audience are primarily a biking audience, but there's a culture of birding, and then within the culture of birding there are these subcultures, and hawk watching, it's a really big deal. There's hawk watchers, and now we're in the hawk watching season, and there's hawk watchers all across this country at the major hawk watch sites, and Veracruz in Mexico is a huge site. So going down through Veracruz, I'm going to get a bus across northern Mexico, and I would really love, one of the things I would love for your listeners, I'm sure there are people in your audience who have experienced traveling in Central America, and I would love feedback on what to do and what not to do. So my current thinking is to get a bus through northern Mexico because it's not safe, and possibly also through Honduras. Guatemala, I've been told, is fine. Nicaragua is fine, Costa Rica is fine, Panama is fine, and I'm thinking Colombia is okay if I can get around the Darien by boat. And so the hawks fly, essentially, they don't go down the Pacific coast, they basically crest the Andes. The ones, they don't all go this far south, some of them will winter north of Colombia, but the ones that go south into Colombia, generally speaking, crest the Andes, which actually, there's three different chains of the Andes in Colombia, and so that's going to be tough. But by that stage, I'll be pretty fit. And essentially, the road ends. My dream was to leave my house and cycle to the end of the road, and there actually is an end of the road. There's no Trans-Amazonian Highway. Once you go down the southern side of the Andes into the Amazon Basin, there's the kind of the road runs out, and that's what I would love to do. I'd love to get to the end. I think it's a beautiful closure.
So how will you get home?
Oh, I'm getting a flight home. Oh. I'm cycling home.
Yeah, I can understand that. Well, if somebody wants to get in touch with you personally, they should just do it through your blog, ericmasterson.com, through your website?
Yeah, that way, and I'll get mine back to it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to personally watch the progress. You do have a map, and you have a wonderful video of all of these beautiful hawks circling. It looks like a really long journey, Eric. I wish you a lot of luck. You won't be lonely. There are some wonderful people on the road. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right. Have fun, and we'll look for your book, too, when you get back.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Eric Masterson joined me from Gettysburg. He is 500 miles into his 5,000-mile journey following broad-winged hawks on a surly long-haul trucker. That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Barbara McCann from the U.S. Department of Transportation, Thomas Prenn with his new synchronized lighting system, and, of course, Eric Masterson, who you can follow at ericmasterson.com. He's looking for some advice in the South American area. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.